Hello and welcome to The Conversation Weekly, the world explained by experts.
This week, what did the Glasgow COP26 Climate Change Summit actually achieve?
We speak to researchers from around the world for their views on the negotiations and what needs to happen now.
We're talking about changing the way the economy works and taking carbon emissions out of the global economy.
All of these are steps towards the right directions, but of course, with every COP, we have hopes and also disappointment.
I'm Dan Marino in San Francisco.
I'm Gemma Ware in London, and this week we're joined by our colleague Jack Marley, one of the environment and energy editors for The Conversation in the UK. Jack, where are you today?
Hi, Gemma. I'm currently in Newcastle in Northern England, but I just got back from the summit in Glasgow.
Jack, hello. Welcome to The Conversation Weekly, and thanks for being our reporter on the ground at COP26. So, Jack, what were your first impressions when you got into the COP26 Convention Center in Glasgow?
I think the best thing I could sort of compare it to would be a ginormous business conference with the kind of airport security that you would normally pass through on the way to your flight. Lots of different pavilions by different countries setting out their national plans for decarbonization. A lot of people were there to network, and it was a little overwhelming.
So you must have been super busy covering things and sending emails and getting all sorts of stuff done, I imagine.
Yeah, well, on my first day, I just wanted to try to find a quiet place to work. And when I plugged my laptop in and it just started to sort of catch up on my emails and figure out what I was going to do that day, a crowd started to form around me. And I realized that I had basically sat down right outside the major negotiating room where Obama and John Kerry swept past and went in to do their first speech on the day of the conference.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd picked a really great place.
Just for those who don't know, can you give us a rundown of what was going on in these negotiation rooms? What's the point of COP26?
COP26 is the 26th annual UN Climate Change Summit. It's part of what's called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or the UNFCCC. And it's part of their whole process for getting to grips with the climate crisis. The first week was when all the world leaders turned up and there were lots of prearranged announcements. But when I arrived, it was the beginning of the second week, which was when the negotiations themselves were starting to get very serious.
And we should say that you were there making an episode of another Conversation podcast, right?
Yes. We're actually putting the finishing touches to a final episode of Climate Fight, the world's biggest negotiation, which is a series I've hosted for the Conversations podcast, The Ant Hill, over the past few months. And that explores some of the biggest issues around the climate change negotiating process.
Okay, and we're going to hear from a few of the people that you and the producer of the series, Tiffany Cassidy, spoke to while you were there in Glasgow.
Yeah, actually the first person I met was a veteran of these UN summits.
My name is Salimul Haq. I'm the director of the International Center for Climate Change and Development at the Independent University Bangladesh in Dhaka, Bangladesh. I'm one of the few people who's been to every single COP. I come every year. This is the 26th time I've come. I advise and provide training to the negotiators from the least developed countries, particularly on the topic of adaptation and more recently on the topic of loss and damage.
If this is such a pivotal COP, have you seen the level of ambition or the level of what other countries have been willing to offer? Has that raised in sort of concert with the seriousness of this COP?
So several things have already happened here in the COP. We had 2 days of leaders meetings who came and gave some very important, impassioned speeches. They then left. And then we have the negotiations going on right now. And then the politicians will be arriving and doing the final bits of the COP negotiation. From the perspective of the most vulnerable developing countries, our leaders who came and spoke in the first couple of days made a very, very impassioned plea for urgency, to take things as an emergency, that we cannot wait any longer. We need to take it. Countries are being affected already. They need finance for adaptation and now also for loss and damage because climate change is happening. Over the last few days, this has been an issue, been under negotiations, and a number of countries are announcing various amounts of money for supporting adaptation, more than they had before, which is good. How much, we're not quite sure, and how it's going to be delivered, we're not quite sure. The devil's always in the details on these things, but it's a good sign that they're stepping up.
Could you give us your sense of the first week? Did you think that the pledges that came out and some of the targets, did they surprise you? Were they more or less what you expected? Or do you think that there is still a very long way to go based on what you've seen so far?
Well, we had some very good announcements, pledges by single countries on their own, by collection of countries on different issues, coalitions of the willing rather than negotiating between all 200 countries who are here. But it isn't enough. And so that's the whole point here. This is not something we can go away with just making incremental progress and tapping ourselves on the back for doing that, because climate change has a say here. And the climate is telling us very, very vividly that you're not doing enough and I'm going to destroy you.
Do you think that negotiations have proceeded in a timely and productive fashion, or have you any concerns about any problems that have occurred during the negotiations?
Sure. So there are several things that are peculiar about COP26. Firstly, we're meeting here in Glasgow a year late. We should have been here a year ago, so we've lost a year, which has not been good because, as I said, the climate didn't take a year off. The climate actually came and hit us during the last year. Secondly, because of the COVID restrictions on travel, a lot of people, particularly from the poorer developing countries, weren't able to come. There were quarantine issues and red list issues for the UK government. But there are quite a few people here, which is good. They also have restrictions on the number of people that can get into rooms. So a lot of people who expect to be in the rooms have not been able to get into the rooms. So it is a fairly difficult COP, firstly to get to, then to participate in. But nevertheless, every country is here. They're negotiating. They had some good negotiations on most issues. And they are now waiting to resolve the remaining issues in the last few days when the politicians and ministers come, who will then make those decisions. And hopefully by the end, we should have a result.
Okay. Thank you very much, Salimu. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
You spoke to Salimul on Monday. This was before any text had emerged of what was to be in the final agreement of COP26. Were there any hints or anything coming out of the negotiation rooms?
Not really. Things were really locked down as far as the negotiations themselves went. And the only way we could really get an insight into what was going on was to speak to delegates who were involved in the negotiations themselves. But as I was waiting to hear of news about the draft agreement, I did grab a few minutes with Rachel Kite. She's dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University in Massachusetts in the US, which is a graduate school of international affairs. But as well as an academic, Rachel is also a former UN and World Bank official. And she's been at tons of these negotiations in the past, and she knows the COP process very well. And she was actually there with around 20 students, just showing them the ropes of how these things work. And she was also wearing a couple of other hats too.
I am a member of the Friends of the COP26, which is an advisory group assembled by the British government, who are the presidents of the negotiation. I'm also an advisor to the Secretary General on Climate Action. And then finally, I'm the co-chair of the Voluntary Carbon Markets Integrity Initiative, which is trying to iterate the rules and guidance for participation in voluntary carbon markets.
What has struck you so far about the announcements that have came out of this summit? I mean, pledges, agreements, coalitions of countries.
I think that, first of all, the pledges and the working coalitions that are forming across all sectors of the economy. And then, of course, I think the big news was that the financial sector arrived in Glasgow with some serious commitments about how it needs to drive climate action. And notwithstanding the claims of greenwashing, some of which are wholly accurate, we can now start to have a serious conversation around driving action from this ambition in every part of the economy. So I think that's new. Examples of that are the methane or methane. We're having a nice transatlantic debate about how you pronounce it. The Methane Coalition.
Dozens of nations have joined the initiative to reduce global methane emissions by 30% by the end of the decade.
I think some of the agreements on deforestation were important.
More than 100 nations have pledged to reverse deforestation by 20.
Although the implementation of that will be really hard. The coalition of finance around helping countries decarbonize quickly and to decommission coal. In particular, the South African announcement, I think, was critical as well.
An agreement called the Just Energy Transition Partnership will see South Africa receive $8.5 billion in loans and grants over the next 5 years to help transition towards a greener economy.
And then there's been some things which are perhaps less newsworthy, but the creation of an international sustainability standards board. So there's one framework for companies. These are sort of important parts of the machine that are getting retooled.
Do you think that these agreements and deals are building momentum for something bigger later this week? Are we building up to something?
Well, I think the critical question of can you translate that momentum into political agreement in negotiated text is the big question mark, and it's hanging heavily over us this week. The momentum was real. That can only speed forward if we bake in credibility, accountability, and integrity. And the Secretary General has asked for an expert group to advise him and everybody else on how we understand credibility, accountability, and integrity. So all of these claims that everybody's made, how do we know that they are real, and how do we know when they're being realised? So we have that now, not only for governments in the Paris Agreement, but we have it now for what we call non-state actors. So for every bank, every insurer, every company, every city that's made a claim, the Secretary General is going to work on how we know that. But the negotiations are tough, right? It's very difficult sometimes to marry the intense negotiations over how we're transparent with each other, how carbon markets are going to work, who's going to provide the finance that flows publicly from the north to the south, to match that to the momentum of these big announcements outside. And I think that if the gap between the big announcements and the negotiations gets any wider, I think a lot of the public will just hold up their hands and say, this isn't working. The focus coming into this COP was around the $100 billion pledge that developed countries have to make to developing countries. Well, it's not a pledge, it's a promise, and it's a promise that has not been met. And this is public flows of finance from the north to the south. The North kind of fumbled that because there is a $100 billion promise, but it's now only going to be realised in 2022 or 2023. That's a disappointment.
Right. What's your assessment of what the US has brought to the table at COP26? So you mentioned the Global Methane Pledge. Obviously, this is Joe Biden's first presence at the COP as president. What do you think he has really done at this COP to demonstrate the US's ambition when it comes to climate change on the world stage?
So I think there is real recognition that the Biden administration has put into place really experienced, dedicated public servants in almost every position in government that they needed to be, that, you know, every cabinet secretary understands climate change. And then you go to the second bench and the third bench, and there are really skilled people in each of these jobs. People recognize that the Biden administration is moving through administrative and regulatory reforms in every facet that it can, as quickly as it can, and that the US has then, through the energetic diplomacy of Special Envoy Kerry, has been part or most of these coalitions and new agreements on methane and deforestation and South African coal, etc. But hanging over all of that is a big question mark about whether the US can actually deliver against its pledge, given the logjam in Congress. And, you know, recognition that the US is way, way, way off the mark when it comes to climate finance. The United States is one of the historically greatest polluters and simply isn't contributing financially anything like what it should. So there's a big question mark. There's a gnawing anxiety at the political situation that this is still so polarized in the United States, and that so much of the world's future depends on the United States being at the table, not just rhetorically, but with finance and with partnership. So it's a double-edged sword.
And do you think that the US has done enough at this COP to really move forward progress on climate finance?
So everything that they could do without going to Congress, I think that they've done, but they haven't really filled all of the gap that was left by years of not contributing. And I don't think that they've really completely shifted gears on things they need to do. And it's not just the cash that needs to go into international forums or international funds and mechanisms. It's also what is the stance on trade. We need China, the EU and the US to be aligned on how we treat carbon in our trading system. We need the US, the EU and China to be aligned in the way that we treat sustainability in finance. So the EU has a taxonomy on sustainable finance. The Chinese have their own version of that. And the US is working furiously to catch up. But that needs to align. You need to treat environmental goods and services in the same way in each economic block. So does the US definition of what is green hydrogen match the EU's definition of green hydrogen? If these things don't line up for a global company, it just makes things very sticky. And then in terms of overseas development assistance and finance into the poorest countries and developing countries, no, it's inadequate. All of the developed countries are not giving enough. And the US negotiating stance of really not being a leader on loss and damage, I think, sits very poorly with the least developed countries. This is the payment for the losses and damages being faced by developing countries, even though they did nothing to bring us to this point in the climate crisis.
And presumably what will guarantee whether these pledges are met will depend on being able to track and monitor whatever is agreed here, whether it's delivered in the years to come. How do we do that? What is the plan for being able to really see if countries are actually delivering these things that they're promising?
I think the first thing is that countries have to actually, you know, implement the pledges that they've made. So you're talking about galvanized national action with democratic participation. So people have got to be involved. Choices have got to be made. You know, taxes have to be levied or changed. Fossil fuel subsidies have to be got rid of. I mean, we're talking about changing the way the economy works, you know, and taking carbon emissions out of the global economy. And that's, you know, systematic policy making that drives action with justice so that you don't discriminate against those who are most vulnerable in the process. Then we have to track. You're seeing big data and AI play a role. We can, through Climate Trace and other mechanisms, know what the point source emissions are at any moment through the methane tracker, that we will have satellites in the sky that will be able to tell us what methane plumes are coming from where at any moment in time. And then I think we will need to see a move from voluntary to mandatory disclosure by companies, regulation of banks so that banks are insisting that companies report to them on their progress. And so we will have to bring great transparency to the reporting.
One of the things we're interested in is how grueling negotiations can be for the delegates themselves. How do you keep up stamina and stay focused?
Yeah, they are grueling, and you know, good food matters. I remember in Durban about a decade ago, the negotiations going 36 hours over, and basically the only thing that was available were white bread sandwiches, and then they ran out of those, right? So this has a physical effect on the negotiators. It's also overwhelming. You know, people talk to their kids, and I talked to my 14-year-old daughter last night. She's like, are you making progress? Is this going to work? And it destroys you, because what if it doesn't?
Well, exactly. I think we can leave it there. Thank you very much, Rachel.
I honestly love that image of international delegates in their suits calling home and then getting a dressing down by their kids. It really, I imagine it's got to be pretty effective.
Yeah, it was. And I think especially on that final day of negotiations, as countries were preparing to wrap up the final deal, it did seem as if every delegate who spoke talked about whether they'd be able to look their children in the eye with what they managed to come away with.
So when did you first get a glimpse of the draft agreement?
The first version of the draft agreement came through via email on Wednesday morning at about 6 a.m. That was just 2 days before the summit was actually due to finish. But just as everyone was dissecting the text, the US and China made a surprise announcement of a separate bilateral deal to cooperate on reducing emissions during the 2020s. I caught up with a politics expert based at the University of Leeds in England to help explain what it meant.
I'm Richard Beersworth. I'm Professor of International Relations at Leeds University, and I'm also co-chair of the COP26 Task Force at Leeds, which is being run by the Priestley International Centre for Climate, and that is why I'm here as part of the University of Leeds delegation.
Could we start with the US-China deal?
In a surprising turn of event at the COP26 climate summit, Washington and Beijing announced that they will beef up efforts to tackle climate change together.
What was your reaction to it when you heard about it?
I think, like quite a lot of people with observer status, I was surprised, particularly as someone working on international relations. The geopolitical context, as everyone has been saying, up to COP26, has been partly structured by the rivalry between the US and China. What the declaration made very clear is that rather than not decoupling climate change from politics. Actually, there is a decoupling. Both parties, the US and China, are making clear that within the next critical decade, as they put it within the declaration statement, they will work carefully together year in, year out. And that is really quite a considerable change. So I think people, even though there was lack of concrete detail, this was a large shift with regard to the geopolitical context prior to COP26 and even during the leaders' summit at the very beginning.
Do you have any sense of what collaboration on an issue like climate change in the 2020s between China and the US might even look like?
Well, I think the indication within the declaration is that there is a working program that they've got to put in place by the end of this year. They'll first meet, probably with regard to methane, in the early months of next year. But that working program is going to be one where the two delegations, the two teams of both US and Chinese scientists as well, linked to the IPCC, which is important, they will be meeting regularly to review, monitor, and ratchet up their targets, including their national determined contributions. So here is a bilateral ratcheting up, which is parallel to the multilateral ratcheting up within the COP process, but which can also support that process as well, again, within the next 8 years. And this is what is critical, because what this COP26 summit has shown very clearly from the statements made in the first week, the announcements by the IEA director on 1.8 compared to the statements made in the second, and then the climate action tracker of 2.4, what that made very clear is both hope and disappointment. And in relation to those two senses of where actually things are, the declaration acknowledged two things of critical importance. The gap is considerable between what is being pledged and what is actually being operationalized. The gap is considerable between the pledges at present and the pledges that need to be made. And most importantly, what we need to focus on is not 2050, we need to focus on 2030. So the next 8 years is what this working program is all about.
Do you have a sense that it really is actually quite a genuine breakthrough? Or do you think that it was kind of inevitable that there was going to be something like this already and it was kind of just orchestrated to send a bigger message of cooperation?
Probably a mix of those things, in the sense that, very importantly, within the declaration, there is that statement about China going towards a national action plan on methane. But they did not sign up to the methane pledge in the previous week. So I presume China has been very strategic in the timing of its announcements and the fact that it wanted to make those announcements bilaterally rather than multilaterally. I presume that multilaterally, as a leader of the G77 group, it will be concerned with the Green Fund, the $100 billion. Every question to do with loss and damage, the question of indigenous communities, it will take up multilaterally those concerns from the developing world and the LDCs. But bilaterally, it will work with the US as the two biggest emitters in the world at 40% of GHG, global emissions in general. It will work bilaterally and strategically to promote leadership in such a way that these multilateral negotiations can then follow. Certainly on the part of the Chinese, it was a strategic moment, and they wanted to make it very clear they are going to work bilaterally with the US, and therefore it's a question of climate leadership. But it's a climate leadership on two fronts, one with regard to the developing world, and two, with regard to the US for climate leadership in general, where they are the biggest emitters and have to set targets increasingly in an intense way in the next 8 years.
Okay, thank you very much, Richard.
So we've got this China-US deal dropping almost at the last minute. That's huge news. What happened then?
The summit was meant to end last Friday, but it ended up going on until Saturday evening. And in those last few hours, there was some last-minute wrangling about the wording of the final agreement.
We're going to actually get into some of the details of what happened with that last minute wrangling of the text with an Australian climate expert, Anna Malos, who is in Glasgow. I called her up a couple days after COP26 finished up.
I work for Climate Works Australia, which is part of Monash University, and I'm the country lead Australia.
You were just at this massive conference, COP26. How was it?
You're always going to have big problems. But what I really saw was a big step up in momentum. you know, there are some very good things have come out of it. Countries did bring stronger emission reductions targets. They've created more policy. They're spending their money in more sensible ways. And the scientists have shown that that will make a real difference. So that curve of the temperatures being expected to keep going up, you know, we have bent that curve. Before Paris, that was going to be well above 4, you know, even 6 degrees of warming. Now, if you take into account the pledges and not just the immediate actions, that's looking to be around 2.5 degrees. Now, that is well above what the climate can take and therefore well above what we as people can take. But it's a big difference. So now we've got to kind of redouble those efforts so that we can keep that limit to 1.5. No question, governments could have done more. You know, the Australian government definitely could have done more. And the other side of it is Glasgow, there was a lot of movement on the streets, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, but a lot of passion as well. You know, those are people saying to their own governments, we are not going to let you not do enough. On that last day, when it was all getting a bit fraught, those negotiators were saying, we know we have to accept this compromise. We know it's not good enough and we will keep fighting. And they were talking to those people outside. I've never heard negotiators effectively apologise for what they were about to do.
May I just say to all delegates, I apologise for the way this process has unfolded. I am deeply sorry.
And it was just a very different feel. And, you know, that sense of the, you know, COP27, so the next COP that's going to be in Egypt, starts now. So it's not this sense of kind of like, right, we're done. We'll go have a bit of a break and then come back. It was very much, this has not been enough. We are not yet on track to 1.5. We've made steps in the right direction, but all of us have to do more.
Tell us, what were some of the sticking points at the end, if you can? Now, there were some negotiations that changed some language about phasing out unabated coal and inefficient fossil fuel subsidies.
So the first version of the text had the strongest language, which was about phasing out coal-fired power and phasing out fossil fuel subsidies. It got weakened. So it was then about phasing out unabated coal. So that's saying that if you can have carbon capture and storage associated with your coal-fired power station, then that doesn't need to be phased out. That's what the language is saying. And it also talked about inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. Now, that's a highly contentious term because, you know, what does that mean? Who is judging that? So it definitely weakens the language. And then on the final day, what caused the kerfuffle at the end and nearly stopped this being signed off was that India in particular, and backed in by China, South Africa and Iran, wanted further weakening, particularly about the phasing out coal-fired power stations. And so it's now become phased down. So essentially, it's calling for a reduction rather than an end to coal.
So the last-minute change of wording regarding coal in the final version of the pact was certainly one of the major headlines to come out of COP26. But can you give us a rundown of some other notable new things?
One of the new things that was brought this year is that when Paris was designed and signed off, the thought was that you would have these 5-year review cycles. So every 5 years, countries would put in new commitments. And for developed countries, that will be economy-wide targets. Every 5 years, they would then do a new one. And each of those targets was supposed to be more ambitious. And that's what's called the ratchet mechanism. Now, what happened in Glasgow was it was very, very clear that the pledges that have been brought so far are nowhere near enough. So it was like, right, we're not going to wait until 2025. You've got to do it again in 2022. And there will be this work program to scale up ambition across the next decade. The emphasis is on 1.5 and talking about the 2030s as a critical decade, talking about what the science shows in terms of what level of global emissions reductions you need. So that's that 45% within the next decade. And all of that language is within the Glasgow Climate Pact. There's also commitments to scale up adaptation finance from the 2019 level, doubling it. And then the very contentious area as well was around something called loss and damage. And so there is this sense, particularly for vulnerable countries that are being affected by climate change already. And, you know, there are estimates that 10% of their GDP is now going to dealing with climate change and dealing with having to adapt. So in effect, those who have created this issue the least are the ones who are paying the most. And so loss and damage is about the developed countries paying and supporting countries around that loss and damage. Now, there was no concrete proposals. At one stage, there was this thought of having a finance facility around loss and damage. That didn't get up. But what there is a commitment to look at this issue in detail for the next COP in Egypt.
So Australia didn't come out of the summit very much covered in glory, if you will. The Climate Action Network awarded a mock ceremony.
Australia bags first place with the Colossal Fossil for its appalling performance at loss and damage and on ambition at COP26 in Glasgow.
Does the Australian government deserve some of the name-calling it's getting?
Like all countries, Australia was asked to put forward a stronger 2030 target, and they didn't. That was viewed in a very bad light by many countries, and particularly because official government projections of where Australia is going to get to in 2030 says that our emissions reductions will be stronger than our target. And if you also look at what the states and territories are doing, they are acting more strongly than the federal government is. And so the federal government could choose to build on that momentum and really step up their ambition. And that would have made a big difference within the talks. Australia is seen as a very influential middle power. In agreements like these, Australia can play a very progressive role and a bridging role. And sometimes it has during these climate talks. However, this year, they weren't in that space. They had come to Glasgow was kind of just enough. So they'd put forward something that's very important. You know, they now have a net zero goal. And that was only decided shortly before Glasgow. And that's an important signal. It shows that to protect the climate, you have to stop emitting. And so Australia's got that commitment now. However, that pathway to get there is not yet credible. And our work in ClimateWorks shows that Australia can reduce emissions compared to its 2005 levels by 50 to 75% by 2030 if the government builds on that momentum with our states and our cities, if it builds on the momentum by our big companies. Some of our biggest high-emitting companies are taking stronger action than the federal government, and rather than government build on that, it's sort of coasting. And that is not seen well globally.
What about the part of the final pact that you mentioned earlier? This is that part that had the last minute change of wording, which commits to a, quote, phase down of unabated coal power and phase out of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. What does that mean for Australia?
In Australian terms, Australia does have fossil fuel subsidies. The government would argue that they're not inefficient. But what we do have still is coal-fired power. And a lot of our power stations are very old, so they will be retiring anyway over the next kind of decade or two. The question is when exactly they are retired. And for Australia, it's less about them likely to be replaced with coal-fired power stations. However, because we also export a large amount of coal, we're one of the big global exporters of coal, both coal that gets used in steel production, but also thermal coal, so coal used for electricity, then what other countries do really matters. So the Australian government still believe that there is a role for coal within a net zero economy. The work by the International Energy Agency, the work we do around pathways to net zero and to ensuring that we stay within a safe carbon budget, so the amount of carbon you can, carbon dioxide and equivalent gases that you can emit without breaking through that limit of climate change, then our modelling shows that you've got to get out of coal. You've got to get out of coal domestically and globally. Australia has to stop exporting coal.
So that's the view from Australia, which is an important one given their role in coal and emissions globally. So, Jack, I feel like coming out of COP26, there's a decent bit of momentum, but the future's still uncertain. How do you feel?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that it helps sometimes to take a look back at how far the UN climate negotiation process has come. You know, it wasn't really that long ago that there was widespread misinformation and there were a lot of people who didn't think climate change was even happening. So it helps to think at least that we have arrived at a point where the countries of the world are all unanimous that climate change is happening and that it's also a major threat to life on Earth.
So what you're saying, Jack, is that the scientific consensus is there and countries have all acknowledged that the problem is real. The question really is, are we going to do what we need to do in time to solve that problem? So to end this episode, we're actually going to head far away from Glasgow to hear from a scientist who's based in a country which is at very high risk from climate change, and that's Indonesia.
My name is Intan Suci Nurhati. I'm a senior scientist at the National Research and Innovations Agency in Indonesia. I'm a paleoceanographer by training, so my work is basically reconstructing past climate and ocean conditions.
Intan's also an author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC.
We know from many research results, as well as the IPCC report, what people fear right now is not only more extreme events that people could feel from changes in the precipitation, rainfall, and heat, but also what we need to anticipate is the slow onset changes that are affected by climate change or caused by climate change, such as ocean acidifications and deoxygenations. In short, as we have more carbon dioxide in our atmosphere that's being absorbed by the oceans, that has the effects of our oceans becoming more acidic. And the effects of ocean acidifications and less of oxygen in the oceans would affect our marine life, particularly in Indonesia, where we have the highest biodiversity of coral reef. If you think about coral reef being made of chalk-like materials, and then we have oceans that are more acidified, then the idea of chalk and acid just don't mix well. So our marine organism will have more difficulty to grow and live more sustainably.
And you're witnessing this at the moment, are you?
With coral reef, we've seen the effects of heat, the effect of marine heat wave for corals, and that bleach corals. And that's something that society could see right away because the corals die quickly. But something that as a scientist, I would like to highlight is, although we feel something that are so short-term, there's also long-term effects that we need to anticipate where the science are clear. And these are the effects of ocean acidifications and deoxygenations. You wouldn't feel it right away like a flooding and coral bleaching, but this is something that would sort of eat us slowly. And as a scientist, this has been a challenge to raise this issue and to just make people also pay attention on these slow onset changes on climate change, because it will happen. We've seen that in the past, right? We anticipated that our planet will get warmer, that our oceans are becoming more acid, and the same thing happens with deoxygenations and with marine heat wave. So we have to have a long perspective, not just what we feel today, but what we'll be feeling for many, many decades to come.
Okay, so you set out there really clearly as a scientist what you're witnessing and what you're worried about. So what's it been like for you to follow the news of COP from Indonesia?
Yes, as a scientist and many people who are very concerned about climate change, we have been keen to hear breakthrough from the COP26. things that we all are anticipating to hear, such as the Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, the Glasgow Pact, and the commitment to reduce emissions of methane. All of these are steps towards the right directions. But of course, with every COP, we have hopes and also then always disappointment, not because the achievements are not great, but the fact that we have put so much effort and there's so much scientific information before the convention that the results should be at least on par.
So what's your reaction to the final Glasgow Climate Pact and what was agreed?
I have respect for all the climate negotiators out there, but what was said very clearly by Alok Sharma, we are on track, but the pulse is weak. The climate changes are accelerating, right? So the effort has to be accelerated as well. So if we're not keeping this momentum, then we might lose it.
Because just the goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius and keeping global warming to that is just about alive, and it's reiterated in the pact. But for you and what you're seeing, what's the difference between keeping warming to 1.5 and, say, 2 degrees in Indonesia?
Yes, I think the difference between 1.5 and 2 degree would be sea level rise. And this was highlighted in the IPCC report. So we know, like, living in Jakarta, we are sinking, and in rainy season like this, we always worry that it'll get flooded. It kind of becomes rain and flood. It wasn't like that before. And it wasn't just because of climate change, but it's also because of local actions, such as the use of groundwater in Indonesia. And it's very difficult to run away from these effects. Heat is the engine of climate change. But to some extent, we could avoid heat when we have the resources. For example, when we have AC installed, right? But when you deal with rainfall floods, I mean, our house was flooded a year and a half ago. You couldn't run from it, right? That's it. So those two impacts of climate change that I worry most, that people who even never heard of climate change will definitely feel.
And that's the difference between, say, 1.5 to 2.4, which is the track we're on right now.
And the amount of people you could save, the amount of resources you could save.
This is interesting because one of the kind of sticking points of the negotiations is around this idea of loss and damage, which is essentially, some people call it reparations for countries that are already being affected by climate change through things like, as you just said, floods or sea level rise or drought. So would you have liked to see more action on loss and damage and this idea of climate justice in the final deal?
I guess my personal view on this, as much as there's a lot of hopes that we want to put in the UNFCCC process and a lot of top-down decisions that we have to do on government level, on national government level, that are motivated by IPCC report, I'm sort of on that camp that let's not blame too much on others as much as then we are not willing to change ourselves. When it comes to solutions of climate change, we have to mobilize the silent majority of people. So we are the culprit of climate change, myself included. So each and one of us is responsible for this. And I've seen a lot of hope in mobilizing the silent majority in our local scale. And this will shift our perspective from sort of hoping and blaming the national or international processes into realizing that we are part of the problem and we need to change ourselves as well.
And in Indonesia too?
Yes, especially in Asia, because the economy is growing, right? So the consumer populations is growing. So we can shift whether we want to harness this advantage to be more environmentally friendly or otherwise, or just business as usual.
It's interesting you say that about economic development, because that days after agreeing to the deforestation pledge in the first week of COP, Indonesia's Environment and Forestry Minister Siti Nurbaya Bakar actually wrote on Twitter that asking Indonesia to stop all deforestation by 2030 was unjust. So how do you react to that as a climate scientist?
Personally, I was surprised with that statement, but I was also curious what made her make that statement. Of course, like, yes, there are reasons why people cut down trees for development, but you can't just say it's that simpler, you know. If you must have to cut down trees for development, then why not come up with a plan to make up for that lost trees, right? that shouldn't be the end of the sentence. So I was actually myself curious with that statement, and we were left unanswered, I would say.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see what actually happens. You know, we've come to the end of this long-awaited conference that the world is kind of leaving Glasgow and people are coming back and assessing what's happened. Are you hopeful that enough is being done to stop the kind of the worst slow-moving effects of climate change that you're so worried about?
The recent change in the US definitely gave a hope in terms of their commitment to action toward climate change. We know some countries are more reluctant to the commitment, but I think compared to last COP, we have to appreciate the commitment to reduce fossil fuel for coal and methane are definitely more explicit in this COP. So what's next is the hard work after COP that we need to keep monitor the commitment.
Okay. Thank you so much, Intan, for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you.
Indonesia's going to have a rough go of things in the coming years. United States, UK, these rich, wealthy nations, they have a much better chance of dealing with climate change successfully. So, Jack, COP's all over. If you could sum up the convention in a few words, what would you say?
I think that this climate change summit could be defined by three words, and that's loss and damage. Every delegate that I spoke to when they came out of the negotiating room, that was the first phrase on their lips. And it was what really brought negotiations to such a nail-biting finale where, you know, countries nearly walked away, it felt, without a deal, because this was such a contentious issue that a lot of countries had to give ground on. And I think that we've really reached the point now where, until rich countries are willing to recognize and accept their responsibility for having caused the brunt of this crisis and to compensate and to help the countries which are suffering the worst, we really aren't going to have any progress on solving climate change. And so we're at this impasse, I feel, where it's up to rich countries to do the right thing, essentially, and to help the rest of the world adapt and overcome the problems that are coming.
To anyone out there who wants to listen in a bit more detail to this issue around loss and damage, do go and check out Climate Fight, the series that Jack's been hosting for The Conversation. So search for The Ant Hill wherever you get your podcasts to find that. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Jack.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Jack. Great to meet you.
To close out this episode, we've got some recommended reading from Stephen Kahn, Global Executive Editor for The Conversation. He's based in London.
Thank you, Dan and Gemma, for another fascinating episode of The Conversation Weekly. My name is Stephen Kahn, Executive Editor of The Conversation Global Network. I hope you've enjoyed our coverage of COP26 over recent weeks and found it useful. In case you've not seen it yet, check out our Global Experts Reaction, which brings together leading academics from around the world to assess the Glasgow Climate Pact that brought the COP26 summit to a close. I think it's a vital early collection of analysis of this pivotal moment in the history of the climate change story. The conversation, of course, covers a whole host of issues. Elsewhere this week, we carry a report from Cape Town on the cusp of gang violence. But crucially, Darius Jovanski looks at how gangsters can and do escape a deadly cycle of violence. Elsewhere, Fiona MacDonald of the University of British Columbia reveals how we can avoid echo chambers in our lives and better function in increasingly polarised societies. For more on these articles and the dozens of others we publish every day across the Conversation Global Network by leading academic researchers, log on to theconversation.com and please do sign up for our emails. Thank you.
Stephen Kahn there in London. That's it for this week. Thanks to all the academics who've spoken to us for this episode. A huge thank you to Jack Molly and to Tiffany Cassidy, who produced the Climate Fight series for the Anthill podcast. And thanks to Wilder Freitas, Nicole Hashem, Luthvi Zulfikar, and Stacey Morford, and to Alice Mason for our social media promotion.
You can find us on Twitter at @TC_audio, on Instagram at theconversation.com, or email us podcast@conversation.com.
If you're enjoying The Conversation Weekly, please leave a rating or review wherever podcast apps allow you to.
And don't forget, tell your friends and family about the show too.
The Conversation Weekly is co-produced by Mend Marawani and me, Gemma Ware, with sound design by Eloise Stevens. Our theme music is by Nita Sol.
I'm Dan Marino. Thanks everyone for listening this week.